Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for ranks, flanks, and kings of war. Join your hosts as they delve into the world of Panathar and bring you worldwide coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Dan Wright.
And I'm Ralph Enough. We're back again in the List Builder. And I haven't seen you since Seattle Masters. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's been a bit.
But you're still active? Still playing Kings of War?
Yep, still playing, still going to events and running events, doing all the stuff.
And let's talk about that. Yours is the Rose City Rumble, if I recall correctly.
That's correct.
When does that hit on the calendar?
It runs in March. This year, we're running it on March 1st and 2nd. So the very first weekend of March.
From all I've heard, it's been an amazing event. I know Jeremy, I think, has been up there at least once, right?
Yeah, Jeremy's come up, and a couple of the other West Coast guys and the Reno guys have come up a couple times. So it's been good.
Well, Dan, tell us, who is Dan Wright?
I'm just a guy playing with toys on tables, rolling dice. You know, born and raised in the Pacific Northwest. Spent a little time living outside of it, but pretty much lived here my whole life and played all my hobbies up here, and that's what it is about me.
Give us your gamer origin story. How did you get into tabletop wargaming, and what path did you take to get to Kings of War?
I think I took a pretty classic path for a lot of people. Warhammer 40K was the start back in high school. Me and a couple friends got into 40K and then kind of built it from there. And that went until, you know, late high school, where I swapped over to early editions of Flames of War, which is a World War II battle game. After that, I took a break for a bit through college, but then in grad school, when I was living in Texas, I got into Warhammer Fantasy really big. And so played that. And then after I left grad school, I came back up to the Northwest and didn't really have a group, and ended up getting into War Machine, because I was living in Bellevue at the time, which is where Privateer Press is located. So the scene there was extremely, extremely heavy for a War Machine. And then eventually, when I moved to Portland, I was still playing some War Machine here and there, but a guy that I worked with convinced me to get into Kings of War and try it, because he knew I'd played Fantasy. And ever since then, been playing this.
What are your thoughts on the state of War Machine? I don't know if you've been following, but, you know, I'm assuming you were playing like first and second edition, and now we're up to fourth edition, which is now owned by Steamforge Games, and love to get your take on that.
I played a couple games of Mark IV, which is the most recent edition, and it feels pretty good. It's not what I'm looking for in a game anymore. Like, just in general, I definitely prefer more of the rank and flank at this point. But the gameplay felt really good. They have really good, like, app support. So like we have now, but they have a lot of that. So it makes it really easy for people to kind of engage with the game. One of the things that drove me out was in late Mark II and Mark III, they moved to this flat terrain with no, like, it's just like cut out pieces of neoprene that represent different terrain rather than like real 3D terrain. And they've started to move away from that again, away from the flat terrain, back to 3D. So I think that's really improved the game. I think that a big part of playing games is being able to see the board and have like some of that experience of actual terrain.
Yeah, I think the 2D terrain does really improve the playability of the game. You can see where the edges of, like, you know, the difficult terrain or the woods or an obstacle. But you do lose some immersion when you're playing on that kind of stuff.
It's a trade-off. I understand why they did it. It doesn't mean I liked it. For me, it was like, it just kind of took away from the things that I enjoyed, which was some of the, like, cinematic elements.
What's going on in the Pacific Northwest in terms of the Kings of War tournament scene? Because it seems like it's pretty active.
It is. It's active. We've gone through some changes recently as people have moved around. A couple people have left the hobby either because they moved away. But we've also had some new players move into the region. And, you know, previously it had been very much. We had like three locations kind of through the Pacific Northwest. We had like Portland, Seattle, and then like Vancouver, BC, kind of Canada area. Now we still have some Canadians playing, and then a couple of them have been coming up and down to tournaments. But a lot of the Seattle folk that we had, I mean, some of them are still playing, but a lot of them kind of either went to other games or have moved away. But we actually had a bunch of people move into the Tacoma area, and they've really started to pop off and like really develop their own little like local scene. So we've seen some growth in some areas, and a little, it's kind of a mixed bag.
Is that Robert Zimmerman?
Yeah, that is.
Coming from Texas, he's probably pulling like a lot of that momentum that they have down there as well up to the Northwest. So
he moved to Tacoma, where we actually had a couple people, like two or three guys like playing every once in a while in a store that like lived in Tacoma. And so he's been really able to kind of pull people together. And then he's been working with, we had another guy move to Tacoma from New Zealand who played in New Zealand in like the Australian scene. So he came over, and so they've been kind of really driving that scene and putting a lot of stuff in, a lot of work in, and getting people playing.
That's awesome. It's good to see a vibrant scene. You know, ultimately you guys have a pretty good spread out scene too across international border.
It's, you know, multiple hour drives between them, even like, so it becomes very difficult to kind of coordinate them, but I think we've done a pretty good job.
Yeah. And in terms of your events, you've got the Rosie Rumble with the Wildwood Raw. That's down there as well, right?
Yeah, that's Dustin's event, and he runs in Portland.
Yep. And then what do we got up in Seattle? What events is it? It used to be like Emerald Dragon, but I don't know if you know. What are they called now?
Ryan Munsell runs one.
Was it the Bothell Brawl?
It is the Bothell Brawl. Rob Zimmerman's running one next weekend. This will be his first Grit City Grail, which is in Tacoma. And then we have the McClure brothers. I don't know if you remember them.
I know the McClure brothers. They're infamous.
So they started running an event last year called Hunt for Bigfoot in the Portland area.
As I hear you talk, it was like back in the day, Seattle was kind of the center, right? And then you had Portland and Vancouver. But now it feels like Portland's really transitioning into a prominent role in your scene.
Yeah, we've got a really good, really healthy group of guys that are playing. And it's been really good for us. And with, you know, multiple people running events, it's really helped us kind of keep the momentum and continue to grow.
Are we going to see you at Masters this year? It's in Reno. It's not that far.
That's the plan.
Good, good. Well, good. We'll finally get to catch up. It's been a couple years. Well, Dan, are you ready to go into the List Builder studio?
I was born ready.
The List Builder studio.
To kick us off, what draws you to an army?
A lot of it is something about, like, usually it's like either a unit that I'm like, yeah, I want to run that unit, or I want to paint that unit. I'm drawn a lot by like painting challenges, like theme elements, right? I like to build competitive lists, but if I'm going to build a list, I want to enjoy painting it. So there's kind of some balance there for me. A lot of times it's like, this unit is really good. How do I build around this unit, you know, and build something that really leverages this unit to its maximum output?
You know, when you're thinking about armies and lists, I mean, theme, does that come into play?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, I like to have theme, but for me, I want the list to be successful. And so ultimately, theme is secondary to building a list that functions and works the way I want it to.
Play style, competitiveness, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Where does the inspiration for a new project originate? You mentioned maybe you got a unit. Is there other areas where something might come from the heavens and say, oh, I got to build this army?
Yeah. So I actually just bought a bunch of models for my next project. And the inspiration was simply, man, I really am tired of how everyone else paints these models. And I'm going to build this army and paint them different because I'm tired of the same schemes.
And what army is that?
Basilia.
Fantastic. So you're not going to do like almost a Menoth color scheme.
Yeah. It's mostly blue and white. So, and like, it's always clean and like, don't get me wrong. Like, you look at some of them and like Jeremy's Basilians, phenomenal.
Dan, you don't have to inflate his ego. His ego needs no reinforcement.
You know, there's tons of Basilian armies that look very good, but there's a lot of blues and purples and very clean lines, and a lot of the basing is very like chapel or ruins. And I want to do something that's gritty, grimy, and like much more like Basilia after the Crusade, when the Crusade is three quarters of the way done.
As you say that, there was a guy that I met at the Chicago Masters a ton of years ago who had like a bloody hand, and he's from your area.
Tom Millard.
Yeah, and now he doesn't play anymore, right?
No, he doesn't.
That's unfortunate, because Tom had a cool army. It was like the bloody-handed Basilean army, and so they were all like they had just come from battle, and it was almost like they just came off an Inquisition.
He's some of the inspiration, because like I've seen and played against that army, and I was like, man, he's the only one that's ever done it, and he doesn't play anymore, and like so I kind of wanted to just do something. And like I wanted to play Basilea for a while. I don't want to just paint them in blue and white, or in purple and white. That to me isn't entertaining, or like
it goes back to your hipster roots.
Yeah, I gotta be different.
You don't want to be like everybody else. You gotta stand out.
Yeah, so I've got an idea for something similar to kind of what Tom had done.
So when you're building a list and you're sitting down at Companion and you're ready to go, what's the first thing you think about?
What is the list that I'm gonna build? What is its win con? Right? What unit is, or multiple units are designed to win me the games?
Yeah, I mean, win conditions are important, right? Like, how is this army going to win?
So that's the first step. And usually that's the first thing I add to the list, regardless of, like, unlocks or anything else. I just put those in, get them exactly the way I want them, so that they'll do what I have planned for them. And then I figure out unlocks and everything else afterwards, because now I know what I need to get to.
It sounds like you're describing a bunch of hammers.
It depends. So usually, so like in Dwarves, I start with hammers, but in somewhere like EOD, it would be less hammers. It would be more about like, cause to me, they're more like tar pit grindy. So it's like, okay, I need the right grind to, you know, mulch this down. Some of it depends on the list. So, like I was toying with a goblin list a while back, and it's, you know, it's very war machine heavy, as goblins are. And so it's, you know, it's a lot of putting in the war machines first and then figuring out how to get the unlocks to have the right amount of war machines.
When you're building your lists, how does meta affect your process?
It's heavy-handed, because I'm always building a list to take to a tournament. Like, I don't really build lists to just, like, casual play. Like, I do casually play, but most of my goal of casual play is to get reps in, to then go to an event. So the meta is always, especially like our local meta, because that's where I'm like playing for ranking, is very, very prevalent in my process of list building.
And by the way, where are you ranked currently in the Pacific Northwest?
Second.
So right now you're second. That's awesome.
Yeah. And Jared McClure is in first.
One of the McClure brothers. The better of the McClure brothers, right? Or are you more of a Ben fan?
I love them both. They're equals in my eyes. No, they're both good. They're both in the top 10 right now, so.
Well, hopefully they'll make it out to Reno this year. So, you know, thinking about the idea of meta overlaying on top of your list building process, obviously that's going to, you know, you're going to be consciously thinking about, okay, I'm facing a shooting army. How do I face against Malay, Alpha Strike, and all that stuff?
I try to build lists that have at least a fair matchup against as many archetypes as possible. You know, usually I look at having whatever my meta is heaviest in, having a better than fair matchup against those things, and then fair against kind of further down the line.
And I assume that the answer to this question I'm about to ask is going to be affected by the army you're picking, but just generally speaking, are you an aggressive player or are you more defensive?
Yeah, some of it's by army. I mean, some armies struggle to be aggressive, you know, all the dwarves, because, you know, they kind of have to play a different style just based on their speed. And same with like shambling armies have to kind of play into a certain style, but I don't generally play like pure alpha strike armies. I like a little bit more of a hybrid because it's what I find a little more success with, but I definitely like an aggressive list when it's appropriate for the army that I'm playing.
You know, you're kind of describing maybe a little bit more combined arms where you have more tools to face different potential opponents. What does that give you, though? I mean, you know, obviously you get flexibility in terms of fighting against different armies. Is there anything else that it gives you when you're building a list?
I think it gives me a fairer matchup into more opponents. And, you know, so maybe I'm sacrificing a little bit into, you know, some certain matchups where they're like highly specialized, but I'm getting better odds across the board. And a tournament is 5 games long, not 1 game. So I'm looking at it from the perspective of, well, I need to win the most games possible, not win 1 game really hard.
Would you consider yourself a proactive or reactive player?
Proactive. Like, even if I'm playing like a more defensive, I'm proactively trying to push my opponent into situations that I would prefer them in. Even if that's them charging me, I'm trying to push them into the charges that I want them to take, so that I can then have a better position on the counter or the next turn for my army.
Making them answer difficult questions.
Yep, exactly.
Universal Battles, do you use it?
Never used it. I watched a couple games on Universal Battle, like some other people play, and I realized in watching those games that while I probably should use a Universal Battle, I'd be much better at the game in the long run, just like reps wise. I found that, to me, a very, very big part of this hobby is like community, and like seeing my opponent and my friends face to face was very, very big for me. And so that kind of was put me off of Universal Battle from the sense of like, oh, it's just kind of like a computer.
Going back to where we started, where you talked about when you're sitting down for the list for the first time, you're probably adding in a couple key units that are going to kind of maybe define how this army is going to work and how it's going to win. And I assume for those units, there's a very, very specific role.
Yeah.
What about the rest of the stuff that adds? Are you looking to, you know, add more very specific roles, maybe augment what you've already included in that first wave of units? Or do you consider like units that have multiple roles? Maybe you have like a Sea Guard where I can shoot or I can fight with phalanx.
I look at all units as having a role in the list. Like if they don't have a role, why the hell am I putting them in the list? What are they doing? So everything I put in a list kind of has a purpose. Now, when you talk about like units that have kind of multiple roles, like a Sea Guard, I try to look at them as like, okay, well, what is their primary role in my list? You know, what am I taking them for? And then any secondary role, like if I'm taking Sea Guard, it's like, okay, they're a phalanx horde, you know, because if say you're taking them in a horde, they're a phalanx horde that can shoot, right? So their primary role is a phalanx horde, right? Especially into any sort of cavalry or flyers, they're going to be really strong. Being able to shoot in turns 1 and 2 and possibly in turns 3, depending on opponent, that's just a bonus. That's great, but it's not why I'm taking them. That is just their bonus role.
Do you use battle groups when you're building a list?
Sometimes. I have lists that have kind of multiple battle groups. I also have lists that are one single battle group. The whole list is just a group and everything is designed specifically to work around everything else. But yeah, there's my halflings list has battle groups. I have a dwarf list that has battle groups. So it really depends on the list and kind of how much I'm putting in. I find that my shambling armies tend to be one battle group just because they have a hard time getting far enough away from each other to not all work together.
Let's talk about number of drops.
I love my 13. I find that I hit that number in most lists. That's right in my sweet spot. I can run 12. I'd prefer 13, but 12 is fine. I've run maybe 2 lists ever over 14.
That's interesting, because I would have thought, you know, you're not pigeonholed into like one specific army type. It seems like you play like a wide swath of different armies, and I would assume like you're playing an elite army that would, you know, maybe the number of units goes down, but if you're playing a horde army, it might go up.
I say that, but of the few armies that I've played over 14, one of them is my current army. So I do branch out, but it's a lot of it was I was playing like I played ogres for a long time and they just are a low drop kind of by design. I played a lot of like elite monster mash, undead and EOD. And so those tend to be just, you're playing Monster Mash, like you just don't have a lot of drops because you're investing your points kind of into heavily into every unit.
What are your thoughts on scoring versus individual units?
I mean, if you can make an army where everything scores, phenomenal. It's great. I think that if you're going to take a unit that's not scoring, an individual, there better be a very good reason why they're not scoring, and they better have a really clearly defined role that is necessary for the functionality of the army. And I think a lot of armies have those. There's a lot of individuals that, you know, you just want, like, you know, Curse High Priests in Empire of Dust. You know, they're integral to the functionality of the army, but they don't score. Necromancers in Undead, like, find me an Undead player that's not playing at least one, because they're amazing. Right, so I think that individuals have their place, and it's still very valid in the current unit strength, you know, setting that we're in. But if you can, the more unit strength you can spread across, I don't necessarily think like, oh, the higher the unit strength, automatically the better. But like, the more unit strength you have spread across all of your drops, the more flexible you will be in the scoring scenarios.
And when you're thinking about unit strength, how does the idea of like the durability of that unit strength, whether it's like defense or nerve or rally, does that play into and change the way you think about unit strength?
No. Generally, I build the list and then I look at the unit strength and decide whether or not like I've got enough. And then, you know, if I'm like on the cusp, I go review. Then I start to review like, well, are these units going to die? And then like, should I really count them in unit strength? I think that at the end of the game, you're really looking for like 4-ish units that have unit strength, like good unit strength. Because if you think about it in something like Pillage with 7 tokens, you need to take 4 to win, right? To guarantee your win. In Control, if you take 4 zones, you'll win the game, right? 3 can be a draw because you can each get the 2 zone, but it could also be a win. So 3 is kind of the line limiter. For Control, Hold the Line's the same because it's basically 3 zones. So you need 2 to win, but like they're going to be much higher, more hotly contested. Any sort of objective marker 1, generally it's 3 to 4 to win. So you need something that can probably win. So like regiment or above, you need probably 3 to 4 of those. And then if you have like a monstrous caliber unit that has usually 1 unit strength, those can, but those are going to be very easily beaten by a lot of opponent stuff. So you run a risk if you're planning on those to be one of your end game unit strength scorers. That's where Orb of Towering Presence might come in or something like that. But, yeah, I try to have like probably at least 3 solid unit strength units that I plan to have at the end of the game. The more the better, but at minimum 3, because then you can win most games.
You know, do you have a preference when you're looking at units to regiments versus hordes?
I use both. I think that it's about the unit and what its role is. Just determines whether or not it's a regiment or a horde or even a troop. That's much more important than like, oh, I gotta take a horde or I gotta take regiments. I mean, it's fine if you want to go like MSU regiment spam, like that has its place. But I look at the units as a win. When I'm looking at a win con, it's like, is the win con might be a horde, but that doesn't mean that anything else in there needs to be a horde. Like maybe it's got regiment support instead of horde support.
All right. Well, let's talk about the most important things at Kings of War. Let's talk chaff.
If you can take some, I always try to take 1 or 2, especially in like undead, EOD, any sort of like shambling or like slow army where you're going to be outspeeded. Chaff lets you kind of negate some of their speed advantage by dictating some charges that you're going to receive. Like you're sacking the chaff, but you're drawing your opponent into a position that they may not want to be in. Or you can, if they're not going to take that charge, you can push the chaff into a charge and open up yourself space to kind of advance safely. So I think chaff plays a very important role in determining where the line of battle is kind of going to be on the board and kind of what shape that's going to take.
And as part of your list building process, are you thinking about how you're going to deal with your opponent's chef?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to. You have to assume it's going to be there and it's going to attempt to screw your battle plan up left, right, and center.
And you mentioned when you start off, you've got these couple key units that you're starting with, and it sounds like you give them whatever magical artifacts they need to do their job. But just in general, talk to me about magical artifacts as part of your list building process.
Yeah, I think some units, there are certain units in the game that are like, their ROI on magical artifacts is just so huge that it's like, okay, well, this is just so much better when you take, you know, Blessing of the Gods or whatever. And then it's like, okay, well, let's take that. But I think magical artifacts are, for me, they're often kind of at the end, and they don't pop up in a lot of my stuff. It's mostly in kind of my, either my win cons or like my, like kind of flex units that I'll use in multiple spots on my like battle line or my battle plan. Those will tend to have some artifacts. And then, you know, you have your classic, like, I've got 5 points left. I guess I'll throw a blade of slashing somewhere. But I try to limit the overuse of magical artifacts. I think you get more, especially in the unit strength game. If you can end up getting another unit, you can often be better off.
And on that note, what about spells? I mean, just generally, are you a person that likes offensive spells or more like wound mitigation and defensive spells? Or
I really like having like one spellcaster that's one in one. It's got like a defensive spell for like the early game, and then it's got an offensive spell for like mid late, because it can help me maybe pick something off that, you know, I lost a unit and it barely survived, and then I don't have to then commit another unit. I can just pop it with a spell, you know, because it's got, you know, five, it's five short of its nerve, and I can just, if I do one damage, I can probably pick it up, sort of thing. But I tend to be like, other than kind of a one-in-one flex spellcaster, your spellcaster should like have a very clear role, just like anything else, and their spell should reflect that, right? So not stocking up a bunch of random spells that might come in handy.
What about height?
When you're talking, especially when you're talking about like those flex, like large cav heroes, like height's really important because they're often nimble and they have a little bit more speed. So you're able to, so height becomes very important because it lets you do a lot more. So your ROI just goes up and up and up as you are able to do more with that small base size. But in the general line of battle, not really, other than maybe like, you know, sometimes if you have a really offensive spellcaster, you know, Edge Periscope can really like give you that a lot of flexibility. So like, and that's like a height thing. But my main battle line, height only really matters in my mind to the things that aren't on the line, right? So if something's behind the line, does it need height or does it not need height?
Let's talk inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, I try to run enough that I, especially in like turn one, everything can be inspired. If you face off against a shooting list, like an elf list, and you are second, you're going to get shot. And so it's like, well, don't leave yourself to lose a unit to you didn't have a reroll and they spiked dice. I think that's become easier with the very inspiring buffs to standard bearers. So you're getting a lot bigger bubble a lot of the time. But I tend to only run two, maybe three inspirers, spellcaster inspirers. If other units that have another role have inspiring, then that's just like a bonus role. Once again, it's like, that's not what I bought them for, but I'll take it.
Command orders. Have you had a chance to play with them?
I've played one game. I've watched a lot of games and I've talked a lot about them. I was traveling for the holidays a bit, but a couple of my buddies played a bunch of games and they kind of downloaded me on like their experiences. And they've been playing with command orders since they came out. And even in my one game, I took no bonus dice. I just played a list. But in that one game, I saw a change. Like I saw I could take, I had, so I have, Boots of Striding, the one of the army orders would give me Strider. So I could just take a red die for 10 points and likely always have that order that I could use anywhere for 5 points less than Boosted Striding that I could only use once on one unit. So I think there is some place for them, right? There's like this, like good things. But I don't see them being this take all the dice, you know, three reds. I think that takes away like 30 points is a lot to take away from the rest of your list. So I think generals that build lists where the list works and it isn't relying on command orders to do things are going to be more successful in the long run. Sure, command orders may spike certain games, but I don't think they're going to be consistent because you have to roll dice for them, and we all know how hitting on fours works. I'm a little leery of like relying on command dice for more than, you know, anything more than a four cost order.
I do think it's going to be faction specific. There's certain factions that have currently have better orders than others.
I think 80% of the factions have good faction orders. Reading through them, I could immediately see list archetypes that would want it. Sure, there's some that aren't going to, in certain factions, there's some alternate archetypes that are going to be like, well, these orders are useless to me. But I can definitely see some builds coming out of those. And I think some will see some builds that we haven't seen a lot of maybe pop up, and a good player is going to really exploit those. 4 months in is in any sort of meta development is way too early for people to be like, these are awful or these are great. I think it good players are going to shake it out over a much longer period because they're going to take the time to go, well, this might be good, but I need to get 50 reps in to really see what the data says on like how this impacts my game and how do I even feel about it in my play style and like on the tabletop.
All right. Well, let's talk about speed.
What about it?
How does that impact your list building?
Speed 10 nimble flyers are great if you can take them. Having uniform speed is something that often happens, and I think I don't like it. I found that I much more enjoy playing an army that has variable speeds because it makes the job of my opponent much harder, right? Even if the speed is only one speed difference, that's 2 inches on a charge difference, right? And so it can put my opponent into a bind a lot more often. And that's especially true on like the lower speed armies where they're already struggling in the speed game. You know, it lets them, once again, it lets them dictate things more. But yeah, I know I like variable speeds. I like to mix and match so that I have a lot of different things that need to be accounted for. Because then it's more likely that something will get missed.
And what about flyers? Because you talked about speed 10, nimble flyer. Like, flyers aren't all necessarily speed 10, but are you thinking about flyers, adding them to the list? And then also, what are you doing to mitigate your opponent's flyers?
Yeah, I'm always thinking about mitigating flyers because, you know, there's always a chance that, you know, you're going to run into, you know, some Drakon Riders or some Aloe, and you know, they're not necessarily nimble, but they're still speed 10, and they're gonna cause problems if you don't have a way to account for them. Beyond that, like, any flyers that I'm gonna put in my list need to really have a role. I don't just put a flyer in for the sake of having a flyer. If I can afford the points and it'll do something for me, then that's great. Because it's fitting into kind of that overarching game plan that I'm building with a list. Every piece has its purpose and is supposed to be doing something. And if it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing, I'm probably losing the game.
Let's talk deployment. Are you specifically thinking about how this army is going to deploy while you're building it?
Yeah, generally. Generally, I have pretty static deployment in my armies so that I don't have to respond to an opponent. Now, there is some flexibility in that. It's not like always the same every time. Like, usually the core is the same every time, and then the kind of units on the wings and the flex units are in response to kind of where I see my opponent kind of putting heavy stuff. So but the core is pretty static in most of my armies.
When you're thinking about what units you're going to drop first, are you starting with the obvious units, like, oh, this guy's got Pathfinder and needs to go in the woods, or...
My favorite thing is to drop a unit all the way on the edge of the board and be like, congrats, you have no information.
They have to answer a very difficult question, like, what's coming next? Because they don't know.
My favorite thing to do in Ogres, I ran two Crocodile Wranglers, and my first two drops would be them kind of back in the center near the board. Like, just like two Crocodile Wranglers. And I'd be like, I've made two drops. Like, you have to have made 2 to 3 drops now. And like, what does Wranglers tell you? They tell you nothing, because they're individuals that are fast enough to go wherever I need them on turn one. So they can redeploy at the beginning of the game.
Talk to me about terrain. You mentioned Strider boots, right? Like, are you really considering terrain when you're building the list?
I mean, you have to in almost any region of the country. Your whatever unit you don't want to go through terrain is going to have to go through terrain. Like, you know, maybe, or if you have two of a unit that you, neither of them want to go into terrain, they're going to go in terrain. Anytime you're running a horde, it's so easy for your opponent to force a horde into terrain on a charge that you're going to be in terrain. So you have to just assume it. Or at least that's what I believe. And I just plan for it, right? Because then I don't care about the terrain, right? One way or the other.
You know, when you're building a list, are you thinking about the types of scenarios, you know, objective-based loot, progressive scenarios that we have now, and trying to add mitigation or ways to handle those scenarios within the units you've selected?
Yes and no. In a general sense, not really. I'm trying to build a list that functions as like a cohesive unit. But going back to the unit strength thing, a part of that list building process is going, well, any objective-based marker-based scenario, I need to be able to hold 4 objectives at the end of the game. Any zone control scenario, I need to be able to hold, you know, control, I should be trying to hold 4. Hold the line, I should be trying to hold 2. But really, that's just 4 doubled up, because you're going to be contesting them. So that's, once again, still 4. So yeah, it comes into play as I look at unit strength at the end and go, well, can I do scenarios now? Like, in this list that I built, can this list actually win scenarios? And if the answer is no, then it's not a good list. Like, it's not going to win scenarios. But yeah, so it definitely is involved in the process, looking at how do I win scenarios? And it's like, if you're going to play a loot token list, it's like, okay, well, who carries the loot token? Who do I want to be speed 5, right? Like, do I have a unit that I can handle it being speed 5 and it still functions? In something like Raze, which is like a pseudo progressive, I only need to get there one turn and burn it, and then I can stay in my corner, right? So then you're looking at a mix of like, can I burn your tokens but protect the ones on my side? So generally, I try to address most scenario archetypes, and like through unit strength, because ultimately scenarios are defined by unit strength. Can I win scenarios? Do I have a list that I'll actually function in scenario play?
I know progressive scenarios haven't been around a long time in terms of Clash of Kings, but we've had regions that have used them. How do you see this impacting your list building going forward?
Only positive. I have nothing bad to say about progressive scenarios. I played progressive scenarios in War Machine before this, and progressive scenarios make the game better. They also push the game away from just kill your opponent and you'll win the game. They make decision-making more complex, which I think is a good thing. They make it more interesting, because you kind of have to assess more of what your opponent's doing on a scenario side rather than just on a how do I kill my opponent side. So it gives a second kind of layer to turns 1 through 4 that I think is a good thing. And once again, it goes back to, from list building, it's okay, well, do I have the unit strength that I can put in the right places on turns, you know, maybe not 1, but, you know, because most of them start on 2. So it's like 2, 3, and 4, am I going to score any points? Or am I building a list that I'm going to allow them to score points, but I can still pull the points back in 5 and 6, right? Or am I going to push and hold early and all the way through? Like, there's a lot more complex questions that need to be asked around unit strength and what you can do with it.
I just think it's going to mix up the game itself, in the sense that it's not going to feel maybe formulaic. You know, like with push, you're like, okay, we're each going to hold 3 on each side and we're going to take fight for the middle. But like, it's asking, you know, progressive scenarios are asking different questions, and it probably is pushing us to make sure that really, you know, I think speed is going to be even more important in those scenarios. But you know, I don't know. We'll see. I'm looking forward to it.
I think the slower armies are going to have to look at it as, okay, well, I have to build an army assuming that I'm going to lose progressive scoring on turns 2 and 3, right? Like, my opponent's going to score those turns. And so then I have to account for that and go, I have to have enough items at the end of the game to swing that pendulum back to my side, right? And so they're playing, so a speed army's playing one game, whereas something like an EOD is playing a completely different game at the same time. And they're looking at scenario scoring from different through different viewpoints.
Does the scoring system of the event that you're attending with this list affect your construction?
I assume you're talking about like whether it's like Blackjack or
Northern Kings or Straight Out of the Book.
Not really. I think ultimately in any of those, if you win scenario, you're going to win the game and you're going to score more points. I think that's ultimately what drives my list building, is like winning scenarios so that I can win games. And then I just kind of let the scoring do its own thing.
Does the fact that we play on clocks affect your list building?
No. If you're going to build a list, you clocks are just a reality. If you can't play your list inside of a clock time at the point that you take it to a tournament, you haven't practiced enough to get your timing down below clock time. Or you've built a list that you aren't capable of playing on a clock. And that ultimately comes back to the list builder, not the list itself. Because I've seen people like Travis Tim play huge goblin armies on a clock just fine. So it's not that the list is incapable of playing on a clock. It's that the player has not gotten the reps in to learn clock play.
At its core, Kings of War is about the player, not the list. Yes, you can make a bad list. Yes, you can make a good list. But player skill can still trump all that.
I think a lot of clocks is just practice, right? I think people just don't practice on clocks. And then they are surprised when they can't get inside the time. Like we locally, we practice on clocks a lot, especially with like when we bring in new players, you know, the first learning games, we don't. Obviously, because that would just be overwhelming. And I think that's bad for community building. But we take the time to just like talk through games. And then, once people get to a certain point, we say, okay, well, now we're going to introduce this element, this clock element. And then initially we just go, don't worry about the clock. Just practice tapping it. Right. If you go over, we're not stopping. We're just going to keep playing so that they can learn, hey, how far over am I? You know, if they're, you know, 10 minutes over, it's like, okay, well, where can we have cut down time? Where were you spending a lot of your time? And like, we look at it as just another skill that we slowly develop, and we let people develop in a way that isn't, oppressive to like their enjoyment of the game.
So when you're building a list, are you thinking about whether or not you want to go first or second?
Yeah, generally I want to go first in almost any list. I think that going first generally gives you the edge. There's maybe a couple lists, like some like 18 inch shooting lists, that are going to want to go second, because they maybe are like 18 inch shooting without scout, so if their opponent isn't paying attention, they can get shots without having to move. So that there's some lists that I think want to go second, but I think in general most lists want to go first, or the lists that don't care, first is just generally better in my opinion, because you can then start dictating pace of the game. You can dictate kind of almost immediately. You can dictate where the game is, the fight is going to take place. And then in a lot of scenarios that matters, right? Because you can force the fight to be closer to things that you want to score and away from things that they're trying to score.
So we get this annual update, Clash of Kings, you know, every year. How has that affected your list building process?
Oh, it's great. I think if they didn't do the Clash of Kings, I would have stopped playing this game a long time ago because it would have gotten stagnant. Having yearly just tweaks and adjustments means that you see something rise in the meta and like, you know, okay, if it gets too strong, like it's going to be dealt with, right? Like the data is there, especially now that we have like the list building app, like the rules council can pull raw data and be like, this is showing up in 98.7% of lists. Like that's too much. But I think Clash of Kings makes list building more enjoyable because it kind of resets the clock on like ideas every year. So it's like you get a year to really play with things. And, you know, maybe you're like, I found this thing that's broken and I'm going to enjoy it while I have it. And then you get to look forward, at least for me, I get to look forward to now they've taken it away. Well, what do I do now? Like, what's the next thing?
Now, we've talked a lot and you're really a competitive guy at heart, but I'm curious, does the hobby ever trump list building in the sense that like there's this cool model or this cool unit and you've got to paint it even if it's not effective on the table? Does that ever trump your what you put in your list?
Generally, my hobby invasion of my list building is finding models that are too big for the bases that they're supposed to be on and then playing them on exceptional base sizes, even though that's not the most competitive way. The number of Titans that I have on 100 by 100 is too many.
Does your list building process change based on the amount of points you're playing?
Oh, yeah, it's got to. I mean, even like, I think like 2250 to 2300, like it's the same. But as soon as you go down to like 2000, one, it has to because you've changed your maximum unlock. Like your you know, 1995 changes things mechanically in list building. So yeah, it does. And I mean, like if I was to go to like one of the Texas 2500 tournaments, you know, it's got to, because my lists are meant to be cohesive units. So they're not really designed to just add 200 points on or take 300 points away without kind of fundamentally breaking what it's designed to do. It's very hard for me to just like plug and play pieces. Everything kind of has, everything's kind of connected in my list. So I generally, when I go to like a, like Refugees of the Old World is lower points. I tend to have to rebuild a list from the ground up to go there. And then that one, they give you a free unit. So if I'm rebuilding, I also try and include that unit as part of my build so that it's not just an add-on and it's actually a functional piece of the army.
What's the most overlooked thing that impacts successful list building?
Peer review. Make a list and show it to your buddies and be like, hey, does this look good? What does this look like? A number of times that I've like shown this to like the McClure brothers or like Dustin, and he's just been like, why not this other thing? And I'm like, oh, I didn't even think of that. I think that's very overlooked. People try and like hold their list as like secrets. And I mean, good lists are going to win with good players. So like get the peer review.
What's the most important question that a new player should be asking themselves when they're building a list?
There's two parts to this. First question is, are you building a list to be competitive or are you building a list to enjoy the game, to enjoy playing the game? Because I think those are two different things, right? What is your goal in play? And then like after that, it's like, okay, is there any, you know, rule of cool? Is there stuff that you absolutely want to use in your list? Or are you open to anything in whatever army that you've chosen? I think that for new players, you know, if you're like, oh, well, I want to be competitive, but then you're going to just be like, but I only want to play and make this thing that everyone says is bad good. You know, maybe that's not the way to go about it. That's not to say that I could be wrong and that thing that everyone says is bad is good. And if you can prove them wrong, like, by all means, prove us wrong, because that's always a fun meta shakeup. But I think that for new players, what's your goal in playing the hobby is like the first question of list building. Is like, are you just wanting to come to, you know, the local weekly play and have fun? Great. Build whatever you think is fun, right? Don't put limiters on your enjoyment of the hobby in that case. If you're like, I want to build a competitive list because I want to go to this tournament and I want to start getting practice now, build what you think is a competitive list, take it in, and ask for critiques and review, and then listen to those critiques and review.
How has your list building process evolved over time?
I used to not have a lot of people that I could like bounce lists off, but as I've like met more people in the community, I'm able to like send lists to more people, and like so my field of peer review has gotten bigger and bigger, I guess. That's really evolved. And then also seeing like players from other regions and like things that they're doing with lists and being like, man, I didn't even think about those things, and just like being aware of like what's going on in the meta and like what's going on in different tournaments and what's winning events. And then like, but more than what's winning events, like you also have to look at obviously who's playing those lists and what they were doing with them has really become an integral part of like kind of how I look at list building.
All right. Well, that kind of wraps up the general list building principles that you use. Now we're going to transition and we're going to have you pull out your favorite list or your current list. And what do you got for us? What kind of list do you want to share with us today?
I've got a Free Dwarfs list.
Fantastic. At 2,300 points, I'm assuming.
2,300 points.
How much unit strength?
We've got 28 unit strength.
And number of drops?
15.
Give us a sense of the background of where it came from.
But like a year and a half ago, I got a really cheap bag of old dwarf models. And I mean like a big bag. And I had a tournament in like 3 months. And I just challenged myself to make a list and repair and paint that army in 3 months for that tournament. And so it came from there. It was kind of a pseudo speed painting challenge that I did for myself. I'd already kind of had an idea of a list of dwarfs I want, but I'd never had the models. And then I got lucky and kind of came into some models. It's evolved a little bit since then, because that was 2 Clash of Kings ago. So it's evolved a little bit every kind of Clash of Kings. Yeah, it came from there, and I've been running it for about in different iterations for about a year and a half. And I'm taking it to the tournament that I'm going to on the 19th, 18th and 19th, Robert Zimmerman's tournament.
If you want to take us through the army unit by unit, and you know, as you hit each unit, kind of how do you see the role for that unit?
All right. So it starts off with my win con, the core of the army, which is 2 hordes of Free Dwarf Shield Breakers. So then one horde has Blessing of the Gods and one horde has Chant of Hate. So some elite and vicious blenders. So those are my first units. And then I run 3 units, 3 regiments of Free Dwarf Rangers. Those are shooting, but those are also hybrid units that are designed to draw opponents in because I'm slow dwarfs. So shooting pressure brings them in. And then I run 3 regiments of Ironclad with throwing mastiffs, you know, so rangers with dogs. And then I run 2 regiments of dogs with dogs as chaff. I run a Free Dwarf Stone Priest with Alchemist Curse and Barkskin and the Amulet of the Fireheart. I run a Free Dwarf Standard Bearer with the loot, giving him Bane Chant. And then I run 2 Dwarf Lords on Large Beasts. One I give Brew of Haste, and the other one currently has the Boots of Striding, but that'll get swapped out for a Command Die and probably Blade of Slashing or Mace of Crushing, something like that. And then I run a Stoneclaw Champion. That has Blade of Slashing, so the Lord will have Mace of Crushing.
You know, you mentioned you played this for a while, started a long time ago, and you sort of evolved it over time. How's it been doing on the table?
Been really consistent. It has a couple bad matchups, but what list doesn't? It's really cohesive. Everything works really well together. The Shieldbreakers can basically one-shot anything in the game. They're terrorists. Most of my local players hate them.
Do you have a scheme for deployment for this army?
So obviously I have three regiments of Rangers, so everything's kind of built around wherever they go. They're going to go in whatever shooting lane kind of they have. And their whole job is to throw pressure downfield. And, you know, if they pick up units, great, or pick up chaff or whatever, but basically pressure my opponent in, you have to come to me. If you don't, I'm just going to keep shooting you. And then the benefit of them is they're crush one. So, like, once everything comes in, they're just as good in melee, if not better, than they are at shooting. So they just become, you know, melee fighters at that point. And it's all to get to feed stuff to the shield breakers, right? The shield breakers' entire job is one, to be a unit strength four horde, but two, to just pick up anything I need off the board. So, and you know, the free dwarf version has Pathfinder innate. So it means that they can kind of just ignore terrain, which is a blessing for something that's a slow horde. Especially means that they're almost always hitting on threes. There's very few things that can stop them from hitting on threes. I run the Ironclad with, you know, the Throwing Mastiffs, because Throwing Mastiffs are, once again, that mid-range shooting pressure. So you can push an Ironclad out, throw the Mastiff, and then it's like, well, yeah, you can charge this Ironclad, but that'll bring you in range of everything else, like, that's behind it. Once again, it's another method of bringing my opponent in to my shield breakers, right? Because if they don't charge it, that Ironclad is just going to push up right into their face, and they're going to have to fight, you know, a 125-point regiment that is defense 5 and isn't going to do that much, but it's also not really worth picking up, like, point for point. You know, the massive hunting packs, same sort of thing. They're going to push out, throw their dogs, and then if you don't charge them, they're going to just get in your face. Maybe charge you. Maybe they're just going to go stand in front of you and be like, waste another turn. A lot of that is all designed to live in that mid range and pull people from just out of range back into range. And then the heroes are obviously designed to buff the shield breakers. You have Barkskin on the defense 4 shield breakers, gives them basically free wounds. You can also, if you really want to be cheeky, you can throw it on like a massive hunting pack and be like, yeah, that became a lot harder to kill now. The free dwarf standard bearer has rally 1 for dwarves. So it's once again, just bumping that nerve and giving more staying power to the dwarves. And then on top of that, the new orders that we got, one of them being Strider, the other one being Regen 5. That's once more a 4-point order that I can use to give the Shieldbreakers more staying power. It's like, oh, they got hit first, they then fought back and killed the thing, and then I have 10, 12 wounds or whatever, but I can pop Regen 5 and just make a bunch of those go away and make that trade even more favorable into my for me. And then, you know, you have your classic Lord on Large Beasts that play around on the flanks, and they're both there to protect against flyers, but also to protect against anything kind of coming around the flanks of dwarfs. It's a real risk when you play dwarfs, is that, you know, someone's going to turn the wheel and kind of put you in a position where they're forcing you to give up flanks. So the Lord on Large Beasts really, really help prevent that. Being defense 6, 15-17 means that they're just kind of hard to shift for a lot of things. And they're being a 50 mil means they're wily and they can kind of really do a lot of things. They also hit hard enough that they're a threat. And then the Stoneclaw Champion is just a faster threat that is not as tough, but its real role is to try and run up a side and basically draw some unit away from the battle so that I have more time to pick the enemy apart one by one, right? So if they spend a turn going after the champion, then it's a turn less that they're in the main battle. And if they don't go after the champion, he's then free to jump into the back and really play havoc with their support stuff. And him having, you know, a little attack, a little shooting attack with the grenades, lets him do quite a bit of pressure from the side that if they ignore him, he can just kind of pepper the side until he can get into a position to do even more damage.
So you mentioned there's a couple of bad matchups for the list. Anything in particular you'd call out?
Yeah, like anyone that shoots harder than me, right? Because then they're like, yeah, we can shoot. We'll just shoot back. They're just like a bad matchup because then I have to be the one to go across the board. The game becomes much harder. I've won some of them, but that's probably like my biggest counter.
Playing dwarves, I wonder if that's a new player friendly army, in the sense that it sort of forces you to be really thinking about movement early. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on? Do you think free dwarves is a good choice for a new player?
I fundamentally believe that new players should play whatever draws them into the game. I think that telling a new player, oh, you shouldn't play that one because that one's not new player friendly, is just a negative experience for the game. If a new player came and is like, I just want to play goblins because I want to have all the war machines, I'm like, all right, do it. Realize, though, that this is not a new player friendly list and it's going to be much harder to learn. Like, I think full disclosure is more important than telling a new player that it's not new player friendly, but also being supportive of them making whatever choices they want, because that's going to grow them in the hobby and grow them in the community. But back to your question, no, I think dwarves is kind of hard for new players because you're playing on the speed back foot from turn one. Like, even shambling armies are faster than you. Generally, I think speed 5, speed 6 non-shambling armies are probably like the sweet spot for new players. Like, as far as like new player friendly armies, a lot of those tend to be, you're not playing on the back foot speed wise, but so you don't have that layer to think as hard about. Yeah, I think that playing on the speed back foot is definitely a tougher for a new player, because you have to not only know what your army is doing, but you have to account for whatever your opponent's going to do from a speed perspective.
Thanks for sharing that list. And if folks are interested in this list, we'll include it in the show notes for this episode. Next, Dan, we're going to jump into rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me with them.
What's your favorite army?
Empire of Dust.
What is your least favorite scenario?
Oh, anything with a loot token, because then I can't surge my Empire of Dust.
What drives you creatively or competitively?
The people I play with drive me both in both aspects.
When your opponent rolls snake eyes?
I feel both good and bad.
When you roll snake eyes?
I feel bad.
What is your favorite hobby material?
I have a bunch of 3D printed skeletons on spikes.
What is your biggest gaming pet peeve?
Putting drinks on the playmat.
If you had to replace miniature wargaming with another hobby, what would it be?
It'd probably be my other hobby, would just replace it more, which is I play a TCG and I collect cards. It's anything I could collect.
What other miniature war game would you not want to play?
I don't want to play, what's the Warhammer Fantasy one? Not Old World, the other one that they're...
Age of Sigmar?
Yeah, that one. I don't want to play that one.
If you had a romantic evening with Ronnie Renton, what would you whisper sweetly to him?
Why can't he buff my dwarves even more? He's supposed to love them.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you coming on and chatting with us.
Yeah, of course. It was great. Thanks for having me.
Everybody out there, no matter how dire it gets, don't forget to countercharge.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by commenting on the Countercharge Kings of War podcast Facebook group. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.